Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management, Mellon.com, and by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
I know you spent the whole Thanksgiving holiday on edge, waiting through all the turkey and all the visiting relatives to find out the answer. No, nothing about Black Friday or retail sales, but about this. How bad is the credit crunch? Well, it turns out, still pretty darn bad. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. Details at 888-944-LIST and angieslist.com. And by U.S. Trust, Bank of America Private Wealth Management, committed to understanding the values that truly matter to clients and offering a personal approach to managing their wealth.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you with us on this Monday. It's the 26th of November today. And we give you as Exhibit A in the continuing liquidity squeeze, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. The New York Fed is the go-to place for Wall Street banks that are short of cash, as so many of them are these days. Today, Fed officials said they're ready to plow another $8 billion into the market. They're also going to make it easier for banks to borrow that money. Exhibit B bears the ticker symbol C. Shares of Citigroup were pummeled today. There were reports the country's biggest bank could be looking at tens of thousands of layoffs as the subprime fallout spreads. And finally, Exhibit HSBC. Europe's largest bank is going to rescue two of its structured investment vehicles, or SIVs. You've heard that acronym before, I'm sure, but all you really need to know before Marketplace's Amy Scott takes over is that SIVs have taken a beating from recent woes in the mortgage and credit markets, and it's going to cost HSBC $35 billion to make things right.
Banks like HSBC hold these structured investment vehicles off their balance sheets. So while a bank might set up an SIV, it's not technically responsible for any losses. Peter Crane of Crane Data says that doesn't mean the bank wouldn't take the blame.
I guess a way of putting it would be your kid becomes of legal age, but if he does something wrong, the police might come to you to back him.
Today, HSBC said it will move the two SIVs onto its balance sheet. It'll also pump as much as $35 billion into the funds to avoid a fire sale of their assets.
They don't want to do it, but it's the lesser of evils.
Small investors could benefit, too. Crane says money market funds invested about $6 billion in one of the SIVs. HSBC's structured vehicles aren't the only ones in the shop. SIVs make money by selling short-term debt and investing in longer-term securities like mortgage-backed bonds. Several U.S. banks, including Citigroup and Bank of America, are setting up a special fund to buy those securities. Standard & Poor's analyst Richard Barnes says HSBC wanted its own solution.
I think it's seen as more of a kind of U.S. solution, and HSBC's decided to follow its own path.
Barnes doesn't think funding the two SIVs will hurt HSBC's bottom line, but the bank is still assessing the damage from the subprime mortgage meltdown. Today, analysts at Goldman Sachs warned that HSBC may have to set aside another $12 billion to cover bad debts. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Speaking of bad debts, New York Senator Charles Schumer said today he wants federal regulators to take a closer look at Countrywide. The troubled mortgage lender has been borrowing heavily from the federal home loan bank system to keep itself going. Schumer is worried the $51 billion worth of taxpayer money that Countrywide has borrowed could go the way of so many other subprime investments. This has been a big year for the United Auto Workers Union. Strikes at two of the big three car makers, major new contracts at all three of them. And today, workers at the country's largest casino voted to sign up for union cards. About 3,000 dealers at Foxwoods in Connecticut will be represented by the UAW. It's the first union to break into one of those tribal casinos, and Marketplace's Elisa Roth tells us who really hit the jackpot.
Until this year, many tribes claimed that as sovereign nations, they were exempt from federal labor laws, which meant they didn't have to give casino workers the right to unionize or bargain collectively. A lawsuit in California changed that. The Foxwoods vote is the first practical application of that change. Bill Thompson studies the gaming industry at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas.
I think this is a signal that we're going to bring the tribes into the same legal framework as other casinos regarding rights of workers and rights of players and rights of other people that are in the establishment. And this is a good thing.
The National Indian Gaming Association says tribal casinos brought in more than $25 billion last year. About a third of the jobs in the gaming industry are in tribal casinos. As for the UAW, casino employees may sound like a far cry from auto workers, but despite its name, the UAW has always had a broad mission. Gene Carroll is with the Cornell School of Industrial and Labor Relations, and he says that inclusive approach is especially important as union membership declines nationwide.
You have more members, you have more political contributions to its PAC fund, you have higher rate of voting in elections. Union people vote in larger numbers than non-union people, and there is a general enhancement of the union's goals if you have more members, particularly in diverse industries.
And the UAW is already familiar with the needs of workers in the gaming industry. The union represents employees at three casinos in the Detroit area. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Competition in the cable industry will be the topic of conversation at a Federal Communications Commission meeting tomorrow. The chairman of the FCC wants more competition, not just from satellite television outfits, but from phone companies, too. They're laying fiber optic cables so they can sell us video and internet services. The cable industry doesn't think much of the chairman's proposals. No news there. But neither do some other members of the commission itself. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
Under rules adopted in the 1980s, the FCC can begin limiting cable's clout once cable lines have reached 70% of the nation's households and when 70% of those households choose cable service. Andrew Schwartzman of the Media Access Project thinks it's time for the FCC to acknowledge the 70-70 threshold has been crossed.
We think they reached it several years ago.
The chairman of the FCC, Kevin Martin, agrees. He's using statistics from the Television and Cable Factbook, which has meticulously gathered information on the cable industry for 60 years. But publisher Dan Warren says the numbers are incomplete, and even one of the FCC commissioners, who traditionally sides with consumer groups, questions whether the chairman is acting too hastily. The cable industry couldn't agree more.
Phone companies are now getting into video. Satellite companies are getting into broadband.
That's Kyle McSlarrow, the president of the National Cable and Telecommunications Association. He says cable's market share is somewhere around 60% and dropping.
Now we're in video, high-speed internet, and increasingly competing against the phone companies and phone services. And what we actually have in reality today is a red-hot competitive marketplace.
McSlarrow is worried the commissioners will use the 70-70 trigger to justify price controls, limits on marketing, and even a cap on growth. Tomorrow, the FCC is also expected to rule on reducing the rates cable operators may charge independent programmers. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
10% of 14,164 is 1,416. Do a little rough subtraction, and you get pretty close to today's final mark on the Dow, 12,743 for the blue chips, which puts us officially in the land of a stock market correction. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Vladimir Putin's a little peeved at the United States. Today, the Russian president accused Washington of leaning on election observers, pressuring them to stay away from parliamentary elections that are set for this Sunday. Putin's party is widely expected to win in a landslide this weekend, which would help him hang on to power when he leaves the presidency this spring. Not hurting either are the rising prices of oil and natural gas. Putin has parlayed Russia's huge energy resources into a powerful political tool. Portfolio magazine writer James Verini wrote about Russia's and the world's largest energy project, Sakhalin 2, this month.
Right now, it represents an extremely lucrative export for them. It is the basis for a lot of Putin's popularity and a lot of the success of his policies. Also, it opens up markets for them, particularly Asia. There are a lot of people who think that Sakhalin is going to make Russia as sort of an energy powerhouse supplying Asia.
What about the American market? Do they have aims of getting in over here?
Oh, absolutely. About 20% of Sakhalin 2's gas is going to come to the United States, or at least to North America, the United States and Mexico, which basically means the United States. We do want Russia's gas, and Russia wants us to buy their gas for a number of reasons. First of all, natural gas is becoming increasingly important in global energy markets generally. It's cheaper, and, you know, most importantly, we need it. You know, the stuff is running out, and we need to come from somewhere. And the environmentalists are making great headway in condemning coal, which is how a lot of our electricity is generated now in the United States.
When Western oil companies go into the Russian market, they do it obviously with their eyes open. I'm wondering, though, if they look at the Kremlin's involvement in a company like Gazprom, not necessarily as a bad thing, but as a positive, as a thing that might guarantee some stability.
Absolutely. That's exactly what Western banks, American and European and Asian banks, are looking for. And make no mistake, if we're not yet buying, you know, a lot of Russian energy, our financial services sector is deeply involved with Russia, as is Europe's and increasingly Asia's. And that's exactly what, you know, the bankers and the people who are lending money and the analysts are looking for, is the stability that a connection to the Kremlin and to Putin brings to a company like Gazprom.
Is this, in essence, sort of a fragile operation when you think about the scale and their history and what's on the line for Russia as it tries to get this done?
I think everything's on the line. We have to remember in the West, particularly when we want to think ill of Putin, just how much Russia's history has changed since, 1991, and just how much it's changed in the last 7 years. You have to remember what kind of a country Putin inherited when he came to power in 2000. It was essentially a bankrupt country in which, its citizens had lost all faith in the government. And in 7 years, Putin has managed to turn a lot of that around. If energy prices stay good and they can bring these projects to fruition, then we're looking at many decades like the last 7 years. I think very few people expect that to roll on as smoothly as they would like, though.
The piece by James Verini called Putin's Power Grab is in the current issue of Portfolio Magazine. It's on newsstands now, as they say. James, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thank you.
There are any number of things in this world that need fixing. What most of those things have in common is that they'll need money. More money than charity can provide, which is where Steve Tripoli up at the Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk comes in. Over the next few Mondays, he's going to be bringing us profiles of some people who are using their businesses to help fix what needs fixing. Social entrepreneurs, they're called. And we begin with a Boston woman who spent years fine-tuning the balance between her company's business and social goals.
Susan Labandabar wanted to do it all when she opened her storefront computer business. Save the environment, get laptops to poor kids, and build a really green desktop computer. After a dozen years, she's doing all those things and more. She has 3 stores now. In one showroom throbbing with technopop music, she shows off her company's environmentally friendly desktop.
So this is your business class Earth PC, and all of the components are ROHS compliant. It means a reduction of hazardous substances.
These computers were among the first anywhere to focus on slashing energy use, and they have other green components.
The reason why we picked the NEC monitors is that their manufacturing process is ecological, and they have a disposal program as well.
But green PCs are only part of Labandabar's ambitious social agenda. Her Tech Computers of Boston gives 3% of profits to charity. It has discount programs for local nonprofits, and it subsidizes her 25 employees' subway fares to keep them out of their cars. She says running a business that makes social goals central to its mission is the most compelling thing she's ever done, but it takes lots of juggling.
I constantly have to make decisions about this balance between my customers, between my bottom line, and my employees. So that's where you start to run into conflicts with the nonprofit discount and employee salaries, because we're in an extremely competitive industry.
That means profits can't take a back seat. After all, no profits, no social mission.
We have a rule for this business. We have to stay in the black. First, you have to learn how to manage the bottom line. Then, once you get good at that, then you can manage the triple bottom line. The triple bottom line would be your financial bottom line, your bottom line as far as your human resources, your employees are concerned, and your bottom line as far as your societal impact and your community is concerned.
Meeting all those goals is giving Labandabar something else, a wider platform to share her practices with others. She's been recognized by the Small Business Administration. Boston's mayor asked her to organize a group called Business Summit for a Sustainable Boston, and she's helping the city create an awards program for green businesses. Labandabar says a big insight about doing business this way is that, well, business still comes first.
I can't lead with my social mission. The client needs to believe that it's all about the client, that customer service comes first. To them, what's most important is that I'm there as a local resource for computers.
But that's where another balancing act comes in. Customers first, okay. But Labandabar wants the world to know there's more to her business than that, and that businesses can be more than that.
I want people to know about our social mission. It's important to me to make sure that people understand what we're trying to do, that I'm not just some lady that runs around with bumper stickers on her car. I want to be in the mainstream. I want to have a greater impact.
Are you happy with where you are 12 years in?
I'm not dissatisfied, but I think I could do more. I used to like to say that I wanted to save the world, but it looks like that's a fairly daunting task.
On the road to saving the world this way, she's found some unexpected upsides. One is that giving to her community comes back strongly in new business. That, in turn, has her employees buying into the social mission more. So the mission enhances her bottom line more than she'd anticipated.
And frankly, it would be a failure if it didn't. Because if it doesn't, then it becomes my personal predilection. And you can't do that. It has to be fully integrated into the activities of the business.
Pulling off that three-way win is nice work if you can get it. Susan Labandabar's message to other would-be social entrepreneurs is, you can. I'm Steve Tripoli for Marketplace.
Coming up, amid talk of peace, exit strategies in Israel.
If I can give them a kind of a insurance policy, you can call it, a second home, if you can call it, that they can leave, go to university as equal citizens, why not?
But first, let's do the numbers. Stocks tumbled today after strong holiday weekend. Retail numbers weren't quite enough to overcome those credit fears we told you about. The Dow Industrials plummeted 1.8%, 237 points to close at 12,743. That's almost exactly 10% from its record high, 14,164, the number there. The Nasdaq plunged 0.2%, 55 points to close at 2540. The S&P 500 tumbled almost 0.3%, 33 points. Ended the day at 14.07. Citigroup continued to take a beating after it announced plans to slash as many as 45,000 jobs. Its shares lost 0.3%. Newell Rubbermaid burped down 7.5%. The food storage manufacturer cut its fourth quarter sales projections. Shares of KB Home shuttered down 0.9% after analysts downgraded the home building sector. Downgraded again, I guess we should probably say. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Each song we choose for the rundown on Marketplace is there for a reason. If you hear one that resonates, you can find out what it is on our website. Head to marketplace.org and check out the songs on the right side of the screen. There's also a link to an online store where you can buy each song.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. President Bush speaks at a Mideast peace conference in Annapolis. In New York, the Conference Board releases its Consumer Confidence Index for November. And mayors from across the country convene in Detroit for a national forum on homeownership preservation and foreclosures. One survey found Detroit has the second highest rate of foreclosures in the nation. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. A funny thing's happening on the way to the Democratic presidential nomination. The Wall Street Journal pointed it out the other day. Iowa voters are worried about the after effects of globalization. So worried that the major Democratic candidates are working overtime talking down free trade. Globalization is turning into something of a hot-button campaign issue. Republicans are having their problems, too. But commentator Paul Krugman says its effects on the U.S. economy are overblown.
I've been on the road a lot lately, talking to audiences about my hopes for a great revival of middle-class America. And I almost always get asked about whether such hopes make sense in an age of globalization. Is it really possible to make working Americans better off when they have to compete with workers around the world? Yes, it is. The truth is that international trade is less important, for good or for evil, than most people suppose. Let's start with the idea that globalization makes it impossible for American workers to earn good wages. The facts say otherwise. All of the world's advanced nations have to compete in the same global economy. Yet America's combination of soaring incomes at the top and stagnant wages for most workers is unique. We're told that unions, once a key support for wages, have become obsolete in the modern world. Yet the collapse of the union movement in America hasn't been matched elsewhere in the advanced world, even in our neighbor Canada. About 30% of Canadian workers are union members, compared with only 12% of workers here. And some of the benefits workers in other advanced countries take for granted are, if anything, competitive advantages in the modern world. For example, the Canadian auto industry benefits greatly from the fact that health care is provided by a national insurance program rather than being a cost of production. So, do we have to be protectionist to make workers' lives better? No. All the evidence says that you can be a full participant in the global economy while still paying good wages. On the other side, however, protectionism itself isn't as serious an issue as some economists would have you believe. The most recent estimates of the International Trade Commission show that the total cost to the U.S. economy of all the protectionist measures currently in place is only $3.7 billion a year, less than 1/30th of 1% of GDP. So here's what I have to say about globalization. Cool the rhetoric. It's a lot less important than you think.
Paul Krugman's a columnist for the New York Times. His latest book is called The Conscience of a Liberal. You can send us your thoughts online. Our website is marketplace.org. The White House is trying hard to lower expectations for its Middle East peace summit. The National Security Advisor said yesterday that President Bush won't be offering any of his own ideas. The president will open the summit in Annapolis, Maryland, tomorrow morning with a big speech. There have been roadmaps for peace before that have ended in diplomatic cul-de-sacs or that were derailed by violence, which makes peace perhaps the most elusive commodity in Israel and the Palestinian territories. Daniel Estrin reports now from Tel Aviv that some Israelis have decided violence makes it worth paying for a plan to get out.
The countdown to Israel's destruction has begun, according to Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad.
Some rocket defenders are keen base, injuring scores of soldiers. They are preparing for an Israeli military operation.
This is the kind of doomsday script that could make the ultimate reality show. In fact, there's an upcoming TV series called Hatarchish, The Scenario. It poses hypothetical disaster situations, and there are certainly no shortage of those here. The show asks experts how to respond, or flee. Ilan Sharsky is a lawyer who helps Israelis apply for Polish citizenship. The show's producers asked him how he, or his clients, for example, might escape if they were given 48 hours notice of an Iranian nuclear attack.
At least my clients will run to their desks, pick up their Polish passports, jump into their cars, and will drive as quickly as possible to the Ben-Gurion airport.
Okay, this is the extreme scenario. It makes good primetime TV. but it's also jump-starting a serious passport business in Israel. In the past 4 years, Jews who had fled European countries during World War II have been taking advantage of EU rules to get their citizenship back. That applies to their children and grandchildren, too. 1 out of 5 Israelis meet the requirements, and tens of thousands are jumping at the opportunity. And that means more business for Charsky.
People come here and say, my daughter wants to spend a couple of years in London. Maybe she'll be a waitress there. Maybe she'll want in Marks and Spencer, make a little money, we'll come back, we'll marry. It's a global world today. So it's nice that people have this opportunity. It's really nice.
But immediately after the 2006 Lebanese-Israeli war, Charsky noticed a 150% jump in new clients. And they're still pouring into his office.
We are the minority in this region, and you never know what will be the future.
Chagai Strovice is Charsky's client. He started the paperwork before the war with Lebanon, and he says he's not panicked. He's just covering all the bases for his children.
If I can give them a kind of a insurance policy, you can call it, a second home, if you can call it, that they can leave and go to university as equal citizens, why not? You have to be ready. You always have to have plan B, whether it's a war or not. And this is plan B.
Not everyone succumbs to catastrophic thinking. Hagar Bar Yosef, a 24-year-old law student, is waiting to hear back about her Hungarian citizenship. For her, there's no rush.
The purpose of getting a passport is just maybe in the future I'll have, if I want to work or to study, but there's no need to get in panic. We've been through all, so we're going to be okay.
Hagar is keeping her cool, but Charsky's newest clients are preparing themselves for the worst.
The reasons that they are coming today are very, very painful for me. I love this country very much. And I wish that all these apocalyptic feelings or whatever will become just a bad dream.
Families are shelling out about $5,000 for Plan B, which means business is booming. But Charsky is the rare lawyer who wishes he had a shorter client list. From Tel Aviv, I'm Daniel Estrin for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of a well-diversified college savings plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today for the international travelers among you. Those who've been to London will recognize this.
Mind the gap.
The voice of the London Underground is a woman named Emma Clark, or perhaps we ought to say it was Emma Clark. Clark has been fired for saying she avoided the dreadful tube whenever possible. She says she was misquoted on that dreadful thing, but it probably didn't help that Clark also recorded fake ads mocking her own warnings to tube passengers.
Passengers are reminded that, like all voiceover artists, I probably look nothing like you imagine and may turn out to be somewhat of a disappointment.
Same applies to radio program hosts, we should probably say. The Underground said the ads had nothing to do with Clark's firing. It was all because she called the tube dreadful. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow staggered down 237 points, 1.8%. The Nasdaq nicked off 55 points. That's 2.1%. The S&P 500 dragged 33 points lower, 2.3% there. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Jennifer Collins, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time on the program, the birth of Burger King.
Frigid Queen, that's what the ice cream place is called. Why don't you call it the Hot King? I said, no, I don't think that would go over in Mattoon.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too.
Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.